Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Screen Talk, a New Arts Weekly podcast. I'm Eric Cohn, the executive editor and chief critic, joined as always by Ann Thompson, our editor at large. And Ann, this is a major episode for a lot of reasons, mostly related to movies that we can talk about, like Mank and Borat, but also because it's our Halloween edition and the last recording before that crazy election thing happened. So how are you holding up with all this stuff?
I'm feeling a little bit beat up. I have to say I've been so busy at work at IndieWire that I have been able to, in some ways, keep my election anxiety at bay. That doesn't mean it isn't there. It haunts my dreams. I've never had such weird apocalyptic dreams, but and I am as anxious as I've ever been, but I'm just putting my head down and doing a lot. There's a lot going on.
Yeah, you sent a lot of postcards, though. We both did. So that's something. You haven't been totally blind to it. I mean, that's the thing. Everybody's
done their
part. I'm not
blind to it. Believe me, I watch and pay attention. But at a certain point, you a little Donald Trump goes a long way. You know what I mean?
I'd say put that on a T-shirt, but I'd rather not even hear that name after Tuesday. So one step at a time.
He's like Voldemort.
Oh, God. That's the problem, is that we're so used to movie villains. When a real one comes along, we don't know what to do. But we have to vote
is the point. Now, what are you going to be doing on Election Day?
I'll be watching the returns with some, you know, close friends and relatives and stuff, but nothing.
In the same house?
I mean, yeah, with just a couple people, not a party. I mean, for a lot of reasons. But you know, 4 years ago, I think there was this anticipation that it was time to party. And even without the pandemic, I don't think people would be creating that context this year, just because that's not the ritual anyway. And we don't really know exactly what's going to happen on Tuesday. I'm optimistic. I'm not blindly optimistic, but I'm curious to see what the experience is like for people, because it is sort of like almost like a solemn viewing party. It's not something that I think most people are doing out of fun.
Hardly, because we all have PTSD from last year. I don't know about you, but I had a horrible, desperate experience and woke up in the morning weeping. And woke up in the morning having to talk my daughter down. You know, these are real things.
Yeah, we had it.
We've suffered through 4 years. Now the stakes couldn't be higher. So we have reason for optimism.
I was in the Colbert studio for his Showtime special, crushed by the electoral map that they were projecting on the ceiling and unable to really use my phone or interact much at all for a large duration of that night, which is a bizarre Kafkaesque kind of experience on its
very
own.
Very strange.
So I won't be doing that. So I know at the very least
you'll
I'll be
with
able
your
to,
loved ones. I'll be texting my loved ones. Basically, my
well,
plan
that's something.
Is to be in touch with all my friends and family by text. I don't like it that I'm going to be sitting alone in my living room experiencing a very anxiety-ridden night, but I will be in touch.
Yeah, there are many ways, as we've learned in the last few months especially, there are many ways to be connected with people without being in the same room as them. And last night, or the night before we are recording now, and in any rate, on Thursday night, there was a kind of a virtual premiere of sorts. So we got that experience with Mank, although it wasn't exactly what was planned, because that was supposed to happen on Tuesday night with a Q&A, and the World Series screwed all that up. So there wasn't a Q&A, but we finally got a chance to see Mank. And I think that's a nice distraction from the craziness of what we're in right now, because as much as this is a movie about, you know, wealthy white men in power or whatever, it's certainly not the kind of conundrum that we're facing today. It's a very different kind of movie than, say, Chicago 7 in that respect. But I have to say, I mean, as the quote-unquote sort of cinephile set that this movie is designed to appeal to. I was very satisfied with the way that this movie came out. It's a very
Are you
thrilling,
allowed to review it?
I'm not, but I am allowed to tell you that I'm very excited with the way it came out because I think it's a thrilling way of looking at Hollywood history. And let me put it to you this way. Once again, we've seen the tactic of the social sentiment embargo versus the review embargo. And I guess this stream of consciousness response to the movie may fall into the former camp. Because here we are talking about the movie. What did you think of? Let me ask you this, Anne. How did Mank compare with your expectations for it as a significant Oscar player?
I'm pausing because
diplomacy.
Yeah, exactly. I had a lot of anticipation for this, I have to say. I haven't been as excited about seeing something in a long time. And those of you who know me at all know that I'm the original, film school grad who studied Orson Welles and read Pauline Kael and know all the backstory and know all the movies that this movie is referencing. So I was, I'm the perfect target audience. And in that way, I will say that the Academy, especially the older Academy, which is still the dominant group. It's still dominated by older white men. And this movie is dominated by older white men. But what you have is these two extraordinary performances that will be recognized by Gary Oldman as Herman J. Mankiewicz, alcoholic screenwriter, trying to finally do a movie that he can be proud of, write a movie that he could be happy to have done. And then, his best work. And then the great Amanda Seyfried. I have to say, she surprised me. We know Gary Oldman. We know he just won an Oscar playing Winston Churchill. This time, the one who stands toe-to-toe with him and really gives a surprising, nuanced, very interesting portrayal of Marion Davies is Amanda Seyfried. What do you think?
I think Seyfried's always been an actress worth looking at. The last time she gave us a really fascinating sort of enigmatic performance with a lot of layers to it was not that long ago. I would say it was in First Reformed, but it was a much more minor.
That's true. That was a good performance.
But it's easy to forget about stuff like
and
that.
Lame is. She was good in Les Mis.
Sure, exactly. Yeah. I think she is often underutilized by the
Mama
material.
Mamma Mia, right.
I refer to this performance as the shit-eating grin kind of role. Like it's there's like the top layer of it where she's this actress who's always smiling and projecting a kind of calm serenity, but then you can tell there's also this calculation and also kind of a fieriness to her, especially when she realizes what Mank has done in terms of using her relationship with Hearst as the foundation for Citizen Kane. I think the other thing that's really interesting about this movie is that the Kane factor, I mean, you referred to Pauline Kael, the whole Raising Kane essay that she wrote. I'm sure people are going to bring that up a lot. I don't know how much this movie really is about Citizen Kane, the movie, so much as it is the ideas that Citizen Kane tapped into, the way in which he was inspired to write this movie as sort of a reaction to aspects of Hollywood and wealth and the 1% basically, and the kind of impact that has on America. Originally it was called America, was the name of the movie. That is what this is about. Orson Welles is not some key character. It's not a behind the scenes of the film shoot. And I don't think it takes that away.
No, it's very much about Hollywood, and it also is about politics. And according to this very good interview that Mark Harris did with David Fincher in New York Magazine, it was Fincher who, on the one hand, wanted to honor his father who wrote this script and was very much of an obsessed cinephile and raised his son as such, where they would be debating movies over the dinner table while he was growing up. He pulled the script away with the help of Eric Roth, who gets a producer credit. And that's interesting because he's honoring his father. He's giving him sole credit for this.
Right. I did notice the sole credit. It's notable.
And Eric Roth, who of course wrote Forrest Gump and any number of other, including Benjamin Button, the Fincher movie. So Eric Roth took a producing credit, but he helped write this. So they pulled it back away from the, from that Citizen Kane, who takes credit for the movie kind of brouhaha, which Jack Fincher was obsessed with apparently. And they pulled in this other political story, which resonates today in terms of people being fed a fake narrative about what's going on. But Louis B. Mayer, I actually thought Arliss Howard was very good as Louis B. Mayer. That was a good, there's a lot of supporting players who don't register, but Charles Dance as Hearst and, Arliss Howard do register.
They are kind of eerie. I think a lot will be made about just how much context is helpful for being able to, you know, sort of work on the wavelength of this movie. I mean, some people are going to say, well, you know, Louis B. Mayer, now we know in a post-Me Too kind of environment, was a pretty scummy guy in certain ways.
Absolutely.
That are not a part of this movie, but they are a part of the world of the movie if you really think about, you know, it's not necessarily the relationship that he had with Mank. So should it be in the movie? That kind of stuff is going to come up a lot, I think, in terms of what's shown and what's not shown with respect to the world that they're building out here. And
but in terms of sort of analyzing the movie and its in terms of its Oscar prospects, and I look forward, Eric, to going through this movie in vivid detail once we're allowed to actually do that, because there's plenty to deconstruct and plenty to discuss. And the filmmaking itself is of course, extraordinary. My question is, in spite of the very upbeat reaction on film Twitter, which, as you know, reflects nothing, really, it's really not real. I have to say this really, to the extent that Fincher insisted on making this an homage to old school filmmaking, it's very critical of Hollywood. That part we can say.
It's a given.
It is an homage to the filmmaking techniques of old Hollywood, and he mimics them, and that is, I think, an issue for a wider audience for this film. It will limit.
Oh sure, they're going to have a bit of a hard time figuring out, which is why I think the way in which the media talks about this film is going to be a key aspect of its life to some degree. I mean, it's not like, say, The Artist, in the sense that somebody who doesn't have a deep understanding
that
of
was a crowd
Hollywood
pleaser.
Yeah, but also like you didn't need a deep understanding of Hollywood in the silent era to be able to kind of engage with this movie on like an emotional level. Whereas this one, I mean, the more you know, the more fun it is, really.
You have to be comfortable. You have to be comfortable in the world that this movie's creating. And that means loving black and white movies. It means loving movies that were made in 1940s and 30s. It means not being put off by a score by Atticus Ross and oh God, I'm blanking. What are their names?
The Nine Inch Nails guys, Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross.
Reznor and Ross. These guys did a very Bernard Herrmann score. Bernard Herrmann did the score for Citizen Kane. It's a great score, and you can hear them referring to it. But that kind of score is really not what movies use nowadays. And that particularly felt archaic to me.
I really dug the score. I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm blowing an embargo on saying that. He dug the score, Embargo Breach. But what's cool about it is that it keeps shifting and changing. And yes, it is an homage, but it's not like a Tarantino homage or something like that. It did feel like it was almost like you were watching a movie that was made in that era to some degree. It doesn't feel very meta or something. And that's really cool. I mean, it's a very different kind of homage than I think we've seen before. So,
well, the movie that it conjures up, and this is way more successful, believe me, I'm not saying it's like this, but it does, the one that tried to do this was Soderbergh's The Good German.
Yeah, that's a terrible point of comparison for the prospects of this movie, but it's much better than that.
It's a dangerous thing to try to do.
Yes. Well, I think that, so you're saying that this clearly it limits the audience, but Netflix can push it out better than probably a lot of people would be able to do in that respect. Though at the same time, it's an interesting question of how much people will invest in watching, you know, a 2 hour plus movie like this, as opposed to say, giving it a shot for some period of time.
Well, Fincher, look, when Netflix jumped into original content, what did they do? They made House of Cards with David Fincher. And one of the reasons that they did that was that their algorithms told them that a Kevin Spacey series directed by David Fincher would hit the sweet spot with their audience. So there's a Fincher audience that's
going to and Mindhunter too. Yeah, I mean, Mindhunter also did really well on the service. So that is a good question. And I'm sure that there will be a fascinating campaign in terms of what kind of films can surface on Netflix that might help contextualize this experience for you, because some people might want to go on that journey. And if they do, if it's a portal to films they haven't seen before, that's kind of cool too. What I haven't done, and I will probably do in the months
we
ahead.
We both need to look at Citizen Kane again.
Exactly.
There are some shots that are definitely straight. There's for example, the initial shot of Orson Welles, which is from behind his neck with like dark shadows on his neck. And you just hear his voice, you know, behind his head. That is a total steal.
There's a rosebud shot. There's the snow globe gets a shout out.
Right.
So that'll be fun to dig through. We'll geek out like crazy about that. But setting aside the will general audiences like it, it's an interesting divide between that and the Academy, right? Because normally
the Academy is the target sweet spot because the Academy is cinephiles. That's what they are. That's why, not all of them.
Cinephiles is relative.
There is a mainstream side of the Academy that will not respond to this. You know, the executives, maybe the marketing people, you know, I don't mean to lump everyone in one space, but there will be people who won't respond to this. But for the most part, especially on the craft side, the directors,
craft
the writers,
side is
and all the crafts, they're going to be salivating over this. So the production design, the cinematography, the costumes, there's one costume that Marion Davies wears where you see her bare back and these fluttering shoulder ruffles. It's just stunning. I have to say, just for that one costume alone.
I'm looking forward to watching it again. But the other thing that's kind of interesting at this juncture is that we have a wide range of movies gunning for the Oscar. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, you were saying Chicago 7 and there's Nomadland. And now I think we have to talk about Borat, right? Changing the narrative.
So as you know, Eric, I was not in advance looking at Borat as a potential Oscar contender.
And you did not believe me.
And I watched it and recognized immediately that because it had this political mission, very heartfelt. And if you see if you see Sacha Baron Cohen on the circuit, and he's been everywhere, you recognize
much more than usual
that he's actually allowing himself to be interviewed and with his own accent.
Yeah.
He's sincere. He's absolutely consumed with anxiety, as we all are, about the election. And Borat is definitely designed to throw people into a situation where they're forced to contend with the realities that are out there. And I think it successfully, brilliantly does that. And the Academy has rewarded even the original Borat with a screenplay nomination in the past.
Yeah.
An adapted screenplay nomination is a likelihood here. And he seems to be more interested in Oscars than we might have thought, because he's putting himself up for Best Actor now for this, as opposed, because he's allowing himself to compete with the rest of the cast of Chicago 7 and supporting actor. So that's a possibility.
We don't know exactly the numbers, but it's Amazon says it's doing very well on the service. It certainly did stir up the news cycle with the whole Giuliani craziness.
Right.
And it is worth pointing out that one of the things that comes up when you're running an awards campaign is talking about, you know, teaching people about the craft, the filmmaking element that is so distinctive here. And the filmmaking element is a great story to talk about all the different ways they have hidden cameras, the way they explained what they were up to, how he is playing the Borat character in disguise as other people. I mean, he's at a march for this crazy gun riot thing, rally thing, right? Playing Borat disguised as this hillbilly singer. You know, it's like the layers of performance there are remarkable. And he's been doing this for 20 years, but to tell
that
story in Oscar season.
When you see him, I know, when you see him, when he does interviews and he just drops into the Borat voice for a quick, you see that that the character is so deep inside of him.
Yeah.
That it's effortless for him to just become Borat. You know?
And I think also that there's a degree of empathy driving what he does that's often lost in the kind of subversive craziness of
Agreed.
It or the puerile element of it. But in this Agreed. One, you know, the movie ends with a plea to vote. It's making a very specific comment at the very end about America's war on science and stuff. It's the most overtly political thing he's done. So I think you pair that with the Chicago 7 Abbie Hoffman factor, and it all kind of seems to work in harmony.
Absolutely.
I mean,
and it only what he's doing, though, which by not going after his Abbie Hoffman role in lead, which I thought they were going to do, frankly, what he's doing is robbing his co-stars. Because, I mean, there's no guarantee. I mean, they have
to go.
It's
the spotlight factor.
The one night in Miami. Yeah. Remember that spotlight? It was just Mark Ruffalo and the one woman. McAdams. So you have this situation where people like Jeremy Strong and Frank Langella, you know, are going to get robbed because it will be Sacha Baron Cohen who gets the one if there's one, and if there's two, maybe it will be Yahya Abdul-Mateen the second
because he's
so good. But they're competing with the one night in Miami guys. They're competing with a lot of other people.
At least there's a real competition going on. I mean, it's a cutthroat business, and he's doing what's best for him over what's best for a bunch of people who may or may not get nominated or win. So, I mean,
it appears to be egalitarian. It appears to be, you know, hey, throw them all into the same pot. But in reality, he's giving himself an opportunity to be nominated for best actor.
He should be. I mean, I can't wait to keep talking about this movie. Obviously we'll see what happens on Tuesday and how that changes the context of things, but it's certainly one of the more charged, of the narrative. Setting aside docs, it's certainly political docs. It's the most political, the contemporary set.
Look, if there was ever, absolutely. If there was ever a time, if there was ever a time for a Borat movie to be taken seriously at the Oscars, this is it.
Yes, exactly. That should seal the deal right there. And they've got people working on it. And we didn't even talk about Maria Bakalova, this incredible
discovery. Yeah, she could be nominated. And he's talking her up too. I thought he had a pure political mission. Boy, was I wrong. He's got Oscars all over him on this one.
I mean, look, the guy is a Hollywood character.
Yes, he is. He lives here.
Scene.
He does live here.
So let's talk about
it. I actually ran into him on a hike once. I actually know where he lives.
Oh God, that's creepy. Don't tell him that when you see him around. Fortunately, you won't have to. Another Netflix movie that I got a chance to see. I think we both got a chance to see recently, Life Ahead, opening in a couple of weeks. So we should talk about that for a little bit because that's a very different kind of play.
So Sophia Loren, the great Italian actress, who won an Oscar for Two Women for Vittoria De Sica back when
50
she was
years
very
ago.
Young.
Yeah.
She actually lived through World War II in Italy with her mom and her sister. And she brings a lot of that gravitas to this role as a Holocaust survivor, Madame Rosa, who was played by Simone Signoret in a Weinstein-backed foreign language nomination back in the day. So Lorraine really runs with it. She's fantastic. The movie has a certain naturalistic, straightforward, well-told story. Her son, Eduardo Ponti, did a good, serious job with it. But you, in your review, correctly, I think, put the spotlight on her co-star.
Yeah, this young guy who's I'd never really acted. I think he did a short film or something. Ibrahima Gueye, I think is the way you pronounce it.
I don't think he's ever acted.
Yeah, he's a real discovery. I mean, I think she's solid, and the movie is very solid and kind of familiar.
Let's remember she's 86 years old.
So no, it's a fine performance. It didn't bother me, and there's no showboating in it, which I appreciate, considering that it is, you know, a very specific category of movie with a sentimental
it's a heart
look
tugger.
To it.
It is designed to be a heart tugger.
But this kid, you know, Ibrahima is amazing because he is, you know, he's playing this street kid who's like divided between, you know, the easy life of crime and like trying to get his act together. And there are just scenes where he's just like running around, you know, on an e-bike or going to a dance party or whatever, where he just feels like he's totally in the moment. That's a real kind of Star Is Born kind of performance that I think more people should be aware of, because he keeps that movie going. He's in almost every scene. Or maybe he is in every scene. I didn't count.
One of the things that's going on this year, as everyone knows, is that a lot of the big studio movies are dropping out. So in the Best Actress race, for example, Sophia Loren would have been vying for a slot against Jennifer Hudson, who is on the cover of Entertainment Weekly with a huge, huge feature about the Aretha Franklin movie Respect, which, you know, I used to work at EW, and they must all be really crying in their beer, because that's a big lost opportunity, really. This movie,
you can't redo it later,
until next year, you know. And they pushed it all the way back. So that's another one that, you know, let's see what happens with United States versus Billie Holiday with Andrew Jay. Let's see what happens. The studio movies are the ones that are dropping out, the ones that are expensive, the ones that have to make their money back in theaters. And when, you know, if they push them back, they're waiting for theaters to get back to life again. And if they go to streaming, then they can buy for the Oscar, actually. But Respect is off the list. So that gives Sophia Loren a better shot at a slot.
I could see it happening, especially with Netflix promoting. I mean, the movie it's funny because I would see this movie in a couple of years ago. It would be like a Sony Classics kind of platform release. Playing to an older audience, you know, that, you know, knows who she is and likes this kind of movie experience, but it'd still be a more of a challenge to campaign for her. And this year really seems like they could get that in there. So that makes a lot of sense that they would do that. The other thing we should discuss in terms of dates and things being moved around is the news we got out of Cannes, which is basically saying that it has three contingency plans for next year, which is fascinating, because basically what it means is that they could go in May, but unlike last year where it was just a constant stop and start, they've set a timeline for when else they could happen. They could happen in mid-August or they could happen in July. So what does that mean for the films that we think might go to Cannes that have been waiting for Cannes, like say The French Dispatch or whatever? Do they travel with those dates next year if, you know, the May event can't happen, or do they have to, you know, keep changing things up? It's going to be fascinating to see where we're at that point in time, because now they're ready for this weird situation as opposed to last year where nobody saw it coming and Cannes held on. You got to give them credit for something. They really wanted to make that festival happen and no matter what.
Well, we could look at this a different way. We could say that both Cannes and Telluride were so invested in having a physical film festival in real life with people showing up at their towns that they did not pursue the digital alternative that was adopted by Toronto and New York and London and everybody. I mean, everyone else has gone, you know, at least with a hybrid model. And so that's what I find interesting about that. They South By was caught with their pants down right at the moment that they were about to start. There was nothing they could have done, but Cannes had time. And so did Telluride to plan.
Yeah, and South By did end up figuring out how to do some aspect. They gave an award out, for grand jury prizes and stuff. I mean, they did figure things out. Cannes didn't do that. It just announced a lineup.
And they figured out a they did figure out a way to show some of the films online. which was right. which was at the time and then slightly and controversial.
And then they're doing like a special 3-day thing. And Thierry Frémaux, who we've had on the podcast, had his Lyon Festival and the Lumiere Festival, you know, had the Dardennes as special guests and stuff. So they're figuring out ways of pulling
off. France, they've been moving the selection around and showing it at different festivals.
Yeah.
And, you know, they've been doing
San Sebastian all and stuff
for the past few months. Yeah.
Yeah. But now France is Europe, unfortunately, is seeing some serious spikes. So that it
and
does
so
raise questions. Yep. Yep. So speaking of terrifying times, let's close out by talking about Halloween. Could there be a better moment?
Oh my God. All right. So I have a Halloween recommendation for everyone who has, I'm sure many of our listeners have seen this movie, but some, you know, it's an old movie. So maybe there are some who missed it. I want to say that one of the scariest movies I've ever seen in my life is Oni Baba, which is a 1964 Japanese classic. And it is on Amazon. I believe it's on Criterion as well. And it was incredibly influential on a lot of other filmmakers. And when you see it, you'll see why.
That's a really good recommendation. I mean, it's always fun to try to figure out what are the classic horror movies that actually remain scary down the line. I mean, there's stuff that you go back and you're sort of like, I can see why that would have been terrifying, you know, in 1933 or whatever. But with time, it loses that impact. I like those old Val Lewton movies like Cat People and stuff.
Absolutely.
Where the jump scares still hit. I Walked with the Zombies, one of my favorites. It's just so spooky, you know, in
I
a
love
way
Jacques
that I think
Turner.
Yeah, Turner yeah. is an amazing yeah. filmmaker. There's a movie that came out earlier this year not a lot of people saw, but I recommend checking out if you want to watch a 2020 release called Come to Daddy, which stars Elijah Wood with this really goofy mustache as a guy who goes to visit his estranged father in the countryside, and the person he discovers there is not who he expected to find. And I don't want to spoil it any more than that, but if you watch the trailer, it is kind of a weird horror comedy. It's a New Zealand film, a New Zealand director named Ant Timpson. It's his first feature, but he's produced a lot of stuff. And it's got that kind of early Peter Jackson quality to it, where it's kind of silly in times, but then it can get really scary. And Elijah Wood is, I think these days, kind of underrated. He does really cool performances that don't always get talked about. So that's my Halloween recommendation. And I just want to say, I think that there is actually a real value in embracing the Halloween spirit on Saturday when it is October 31st, in the sense that, you know, remember when getting scared was cathartic and like be allowing you to distract yourself from the world on some level? We shouldn't lose touch of the ability to have scary experiences as a source of entertainment and escapism, as opposed to just living in existential fear all the time. And so there is still value in doing that. And I hope that you have
this
some fun.
This is one
on
time when I will agree that you should all pay attention to Professor Cohn, who does teach cinema at NYU. Enjoy Halloween. Oni Baba is also on HBO Max.
Oh, well, there you go. Easy. So yeah, let's
do that.
You
know what else is a good double feature that you could, that would be fun to do is the original Cat People and then the Paul Schrader Cat.
The Schrader one.
That's
a weird one. That's fun. Yeah, that's true. Not a lot of people have seen that one. So a lot of good options there. Next week, we will be hopefully living in a post-election world. And I don't know what the movie world's going to offer up to us, but I'm sure we'll have some more reasons to dig deeper on Mank, among many other things. So, and I know you already voted, I already voted, but there are still a few days left. So people who don't have their ballots in yet, please vote. Have a plan to vote. Tell people to vote.
Go it's vote okay in for person. It's too late
yeah,
for the mail.
Don't mail it. That's what I mean. Make a real plan that works. And honestly, I do think, I mean, I've said this before, I've been calling voters left and right. It does make a difference to tell people, because if everybody's making some effort to communicate that to people in their inner circle, in a year like this, every bit's going to make a difference. And we'll see where we're at on Wednesday. So, and enjoy your weekend. Try to forget the existential dread all around us for just a little bit. And looking forward to doing this again next week.
Okie dokie. Bye, Eric.
Hello, Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.